You're listening to an edited version of the live Voices of Montana statewide radio program. Find us on Facebook and subscribe for further podcasts wherever you get your audio on demand. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program. Thanks for joining us, and please feel free to contact me at studio@voicesofmontana.com.
All right, time for an informed opinion on a couple of matters here, all right? No, it won't be mine. I suppose you probably knew that. Is D.C. statehood a thing? Is it constitutional even? Talked about it. I wonder how long they've been talking about this. A little while. Is it serious? Let's find out. Also, politics. Is it a problem in the U.S. Supreme Court? If so, will expanding the court make it better or worse? And what about the issue in Montana where the state legislative branch is seeking public documents from the judicial branch? Is this nothing more than a jurisdictional tug of war between the branches? Let's find out. Noted constitutional scholar and former UM Law professor Rob Nadelson to join us today on Voices.
It's time for the fastest hour in radio. From Montana, for Montana, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz. Call in today at 866-627-5483 or text a comment or question to 781-627-5483. Now here's your host, Tom Schultz.
As my friend from Big Timber would remind me, Mike Sanders, it's the fastest 54 minutes in radio, but it does move along. And thank you for being here. Welcome. It's a Tuesday edition of Two Decades Strong and Working on Three from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana. Interested in today's conversation, I hope there's a lot of things to talk about as we look at D.C. statehood. We're going to look at also this proposal about expanding the U.S. Supreme Court, have done that in various ways here. And we're also going to throw in this issue in Montana, which seems to be, I think you can sum it up as maybe a jurisdictional tug of war between the branches. I know it goes a little bit deeper than that. And the issue behind it, Senate Bill 140, which eliminated the Judicial Nomination Commission in Montana, seems to have kind of gotten lost in the shuffle here. But that is something I think we need to talk about. And Professor Rob Nadelson, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence. This is from the Independence Institute of Denver, Colorado. It's I2II.org. And, of course, as a noted constitutional scholar, joins us here, speaks Latin, original host of the program. Good morning, Professor. How are you doing, Rob?
Hi, Tom. How are you? You and I go way back, as some of your listeners know. I mean, when I was hosting the ancestor to this program back in Missoula in the 1990s, you were engineering the program. So it's really a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here, too. And I learned an awful lot sitting in that seat next to you running the board. I sure very much appreciate that.
Well, what I learned, Tom, was when you were not there, I learned a lot about how not to engineer from your substitute. you did a good job.
Oh, I appreciate that. It was fun. It really was fun, and it was important. I mean, talk radio was really, Rush Limbaugh had done his thing at that point, but getting local talk radio on the air, Rob, I mean, I think that changed a lot of things in our communities.
Well, especially getting it statewide. I mean, when we started with this, Montanans in Sydney could not normally communicate easily with Montanans in Helena or in Billings or in Kalispell, even though they had an enormous amount in common. And I think that the Montana political establishment took advantage of that. They knew what was going on in Helena, and the news didn't get far beyond the city borders of Helena.
Yeah.
But now with statewide talk radio, it's a completely different ballgame. Montanans from all over the state can discuss issues of common interest.
Well, and we also, there was a lot more integrity, I think, back then, too, to getting the truth out there and not misinforming the public. I think there was just a lot more focus on that. Now we've got the internet, Rob, and I think this media has sort of shifted to a certain degree and has become possibly a weapon in this misinformation if it's not done correctly.
Talk radio is more important than ever today because media have become so corrupted.
Wow.
Now, in the case of the internet, all kinds of opinions have always been all over the internet, some well-founded, some others. But we've seen more recently the phenomenon of deliberate bias of many websites, the deplatforming of views that the platform administrators don't like.
Yeah.
And we've seen a new kind of so-called journalism, which isn't journalism at all, which is hijacking newspapers and other media to push a particular political line. There's always been a little of that, of course, but nothing like we're seeing today. So talk radio offers an opportunity for people to speak freely, free speech, that many other platforms don't offer, and to get information out that platforms would prefer to suppress.
Was reading recently, and of course, Professor Rob Nadelson, as I mentioned, with the Independence Institute, former University of Montana law professor. I'm looking back at an old, this was last time we talked, or maybe the time before that. You wrote something recently for i2i.org, Lies Law Professors Tell. It kind of goes along with what we're talking about here, this misinformation. But let's move on to our topic, D.C. statehood. You wrote something, and you write frequently for the Epic Times. You write frequently for a lot of publications, the Denver Post, The Economist, been published by The Washington Post, The Washington Times, The Daily Caller, The Hill, among many. And your article regarding D.C. statehood even being constitutional, it started out with an interesting story. I'd like you to relate that.
Yeah, I'm going to start out even earlier. In 1780, just 7 years before the Constitution was written, there were massive riots. There were anti-Catholic riots in London, England, and local authorities were overwhelmed. They were unable to control them, and they threatened to invade Parliament and hold Parliament hostage. Then in 1783, when the Confederation Congress was meeting in Independence Hall in Philadelphia, then called the State House, they were surrounded by demonstrators. These demonstrators were Revolutionary War veterans who were demanding back pay. And they did not engage exactly in rioting, but the intimidation was clear. And the Congress asked the state officials in Pennsylvania to clear the demonstrators out, and the Pennsylvania state officials refused to do so. Congress said, we're not going to meet in an environment of intimidation. They picked up, left Philadelphia, and moved for a time to Princeton, New Jersey. Now, the reason those stories are important is because they hardened the belief, confirmed the belief that the founders had, that the national capital could never be at the mercy of any state or municipal authorities, that the national capital had to be under direct governance of Congress or a council ultimately responsible to Congress. So they provided in the Constitution that Congress could create a capital district up to 10 miles by 10 miles, 10 miles square, that would be independent of any state, that would be under direct administration or indirect administration of Congress. Virginia and Maryland both ceded territory for the District of Columbia, and it became a reality. Later on, the Virginia territory was given back as unnecessary, but the territory that now makes up the District of Columbia was formerly part of the state of Maryland, and it was ceded by the state of Maryland for that purpose, and it provides protection to the central government. And you don't have to go back to the 1780s for these stories. You can go to the cities around the country in 2020, where the Black Lives Matters and Antifa riots overwhelmed local authorities. In some cases, local authorities were in cahoots with the rioters. Federal buildings were attacked. Other public monuments and places were attacked. And unfortunately, if you get a state which surrounds federal installations and it is unable to protect against rioters or is even in alliance with the rioters, you could have a situation where the federal government is in fact held hostage to local people.
So you go back to 1783 and you open the daily paper and you see justification for this model of an independent District of Columbia, so to speak. And then you open today's paper and you see the same thing, this justification for...
Even more so today, because the demonstrators who surrounded the Capitol in 1783 at least were peaceful. I mean, they didn't try to assault the building. But certainly the BLM, Black Lives Matter, and Antifa people, despite the media narrative, had a significant number of people among them who were not peaceful. And they did attack public monuments. There's another way also in which the federal government can be held hostage. Let's say, for example, that the new state of Washington Douglas Commonwealth, because that's what they want to call it, decided it wanted more federal aid. They could start issuing traffic tickets to congressmen on pretexts and say, you want us to stop, you'll vote more federal aid. Again, that kind of conduct is not unusual in capitals around the world. The founders saw it as well. They saw how a capital district that did not that was subject to local authorities could be held hostage. So this is not an imaginary fear whatsoever. There is another point to this, too, and I'd like to mention it very briefly. The founders believed that decision makers in a republic, including voters, should be reasonably independent people. They shouldn't be people dependent upon other masters, because they would vote just the way the masters wanted them to, and it would be like giving the masters two votes. So they recognized that a disproportionate number of people in the Capital District would be beholden to the federal government. They would be employees, there would be family members of employees, there would be businesses dependent upon government and so forth, and they could not exercise truly independent judgment. And so that was another reason for not involving those folks in congressional or state congressional or presidential elections. In 1961, we passed the 23rd Amendment, which allowed members of the District of Columbia to vote for presidential electors. And what's been the result? The result's been exactly what the founders feared. The people in the District of Columbia vote mechanically for the ticket that they think is going to increase government. No real consideration, no real party contest. Just vote for Democrats 92% of the time, election after election after election after election. That's not the kind of decision-making you want to see in a free republic.
There was another issue that you brought up as well, and this relates to the constitutionality of it, is that Maryland didn't consent to the creation of another state when it ceded territory for this. That is no small hurdle to just overlook.
Yeah, you know, several people in writing have said that creating the District of Columbia as a state would be unconstitutional, and I don't agree with all of their argument, but this one I do agree with. The act of cession, that cession is C-E-S-S-I-O-N, the giving up, the act of cession by Maryland of the what is now the District of Columbia explicitly said it was for the purpose of creating a national capital. It was adopted under a particular provision in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. There's a completely different clause when a state gives up territory for the creation of another state. That's an important difference. For one thing, if you create a new state, what you're doing is creating new representatives, new senators. And if you're a state giving up territory for that purpose, you're diminishing your own influence in the national councils. There's no evidence that Maryland intended to diminish its own influence or to authorize creation of another state by ceding this territorial jurisdiction. Unless you got Maryland's consent, I think it would require a constitutional amendment to turn what is now the District of Columbia into a new state. A
couple of things I want to talk about, and we got a breakup coming here. One of them is there an issue of being underrepresented by the citizens?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
And then we'll also move on a bit later on here, too, to the expansion of the Supreme Court. Not sure how much steam that really has in Congress, but it's been talked about an awful lot. And then this jurisdictional tug of war that seems to be playing out in Montana's politics as well. And, of course, Rob Nadelson, former UM Law School professor, former gubernatorial candidate, Montana grassroots organizer, with us here today. Constitutional scholars will hit these issues and get an informed opinion. It's from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana. Senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence from the Independence Institute. It's the number 2i.org for more information there. Also has been cited in several Supreme Court cases. Constitutional scholar Rob Nadelson joins us here today on Voices of Montana. I'm Tom Schultz. Again, thank you for being here. And Rob, great to chat with you as well. We're not done with this topic. We'll move on to the Supreme Court expansion here in just a little bit. But the question is this. Is there an issue of being underrepresented by the folks of D.C.? Or is this, is there a problem that needs fixing? Or is that a red herring for a power grab?
Well, that's a very good question, and there's the answer is a little bit unclear. Let me just say first, by the way, if you don't want to remember i2i.org, you can simply enter in your browser independenceinstitute.org. That's fine, and that'll come up with the Independence Institute website and my writings as well if you click on the Constitution tab.
It's a good site.
If you want to, now to answer your question, if you want to influence the federal government, would you rather live in the District of Columbia without a vote in federal affairs, or would you rather live in Lewistown, Montana with a vote? Now, I think the answer is, for almost everybody, if your goal is to influence the federal government, you'd much rather live in D.C. without a vote. The founders recognized that the very proximity to the national capital would give people in the District of Columbia opportunities for lobbying and for otherwise influencing federal policy that they wouldn't have in Lewistown, Montana, or Boise, Idaho, or even in Annapolis, Maryland. So if you then give these folks the vote, also what you're really doing is you're piling pileon upon osso, which is a way of saying, you know, adding more and more to what is already too much. They've already got this potential influence. You give them the vote, they have even more. If they really want the vote, I mean, District of Columbia isn't that large. It's easy to move to Virginia, to move to Maryland, and become part of those states. The distances aren't that great. I've lived in that area. I mean, it may just be a matter of moving 2 or 3 miles down the road. So if that's really your criterion, fine. But I think that the claim that D.C. is a colony and it doesn't have a vote and it's put upon is garbage. People within the Beltway have far more influence just by the accessibility of the government to them than you and I have.
I read one proposal a while back that why don't you just make the people in D.C. citizens of Maryland? Is that doable?
I don't think that's doable.
Okay.
The reason is that under the Constitution, the District of Columbia is subject to the unlimited territorial jurisdiction of Congress. Okay, so you really can't make them citizens of Maryland when they're not living in Maryland, don't have any real connection with Maryland, and are under the territorial jurisdiction of Congress. By the way, note the term I use, territorial jurisdiction. I didn't say D.C. is not all federal property. D.C. is largely private property, but it's the territorial jurisdiction that belongs to Congress. Just like if they were in Maryland, the territorial jurisdiction would be under Maryland.
H.R. 51 recently passed April 22nd, 216 to 208, again, party lines. Have you looked at that bill? Is there anything in there that really can accomplish anything at all outside of shifting power?
Well, that depends upon whether it gets through the Senate, right?
Yeah. Another question, too. Is there going to be momentum?
Yeah, the filibuster... It looks like the filibuster will survive this session. So if the filibuster survives, then I don't think D.C. statehood goes anywhere, and I don't think that H.R. 1, the federal takeover of elections, goes anywhere. If they were to pass, then you would have multiple cases in the federal courts, and we would be, I think, in a period of prolonged uncertainty.
Is this a real push? Has there been another time in history where this discussion, and then we'll move on to the next one here after a break here regarding expansion of the Supreme Court, but has there been another time in history where this has been valid or brought up with any kind of momentum?
You mean D.C. statehood?
Yeah, D.C. statehood.
Yeah, there have been, but not quite. I mean, in the last session of Congress, I believe a similar bill was passed by the Democratic House. Historically, there's been grumbling, obviously, by people living within the District of Columbia, but I don't think it's been advanced as an agenda item in this way. Now, there have been various moves mentioned. I mentioned the 23rd Amendment, which gave D.C. residents a non-voting person in Congress and allowed them to vote for presidential electors. So the kind of pressure has been around for a long time, but I don't think it's quite gotten the traction that it has recently. And I think the reason it's gotten traction is clear. The Democrats want two more senators in their pocket. But if D.C. statehood were to become a reality with the automatic election of Democrats, which historically D.C. has demonstrated, it would simply be like giving more power to Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi. It wouldn't be like giving more power to you or me.
And not only that, but some even want another dozen Supreme Court justices. And we'll talk about that when we come on back. Is politics a problem in the U.S. Supreme Court? Constitutional scholar, former UM law professor Rob Nadelson with us here today. Take a short break. It's headline time. Here's Brian Bennett. Welcome back. Constitutional scholar and former UM law professor with us, senior fellow at the think tank Independence Institute. Just look it up, as you mentioned. Type in any search and you'll find it. An author of the original Constitution, what it actually said and meant. About halfway through that, Rob, you told me to kind of take it in bits and pieces, and I'm doing that. I appreciate that.
It's a research resource. It's not designed to be necessarily read through.
Yeah, no, I like it too. And I know how much you know, your studies have brought an appreciation to the Constitution for yourself and for the founders, and I'm experiencing that myself as I'm looking more and more into it. Let's move on though to Supreme Court. I guess will expanding it make it better or worse? Is politics really a problem at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, first, let me make clear that the Constitution certainly allows Congress to expand the size of the Supreme Court.
It does.
Over the years, the Supreme Court has varied in numbers. We started off in 1789 with six justices. That was eventually expanded to nine, then to 10. But since 1869, so 150 years, it's been at nine justices. And the one major attempt to expand it during the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt came to nothing. There's a whole story involved there, in fact, about the brilliant machinations of the Chief Justice, Charles Evans Hughes, who proved himself a better politician than Franklin Roosevelt was. At any rate, so Congress has that power. So the question we need to ask is, should Congress use that power in expanding the court? Nobody really involved with the court or deeply familiar with its business thinks it's necessary to expand it. Before she died, the great liberal icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg counseled against trying to expand the court. More recently, a sitting liberal justice, Stephen Breyer, said that Congress should not consider such an attempt. And I think their fear was that even though their wing of the court, the liberal activist wing, is currently in a minority, they don't want the court to become even more of a political football than it has been in recent years. They recognize that the court has paid an enormous price, partly due to its own doing, because it's become such a politically charged issue. And they recognize, I think, that if there were a serious effort to expand it further, that the court would lose public acceptance, and the political and judicial wars would become even more bitter. They also recognize that if there were an expansion, let's say by a Democratic Congress to 13 instead of nine, that wouldn't necessarily be the end of it, because the next time you had Republicans in control of the federal government, they could expand it further and have a Republican president add a lot of justices. Mm-hmm. Or they could reduce the size. So, for example, if a liberal justice retired, they could reduce the size of the court. They might even constitutionally be able to reduce the size of the court when a justice had not retired and simply reassign that justice to another court. Mm. So you can see the hackneyed metaphor here, the Pandora's box that expansion of the court would open.
Does that need to be, and we got less than a minute here, does that need to be closed? Does there need to be codified in some way, maybe even the Constitution, a specific number?
No, I don't agree with that. And the reason I don't agree with that is, while there's no reason to expand or contract the court now, such a reason could arise in the future. Let's say, for example, we had a convention of the states and the amount of federal jurisdiction contracted as a result of that. We might reach the conclusion that seven justices are enough. or that didn't happen, but the population of the country continued to expand, the amount of legal business in the federal courts continued to expand, and we might decide in good faith.
More with Rob Nadelson. That's a good point. We got lots more to talk. Come on back after a break.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
You're listening to a podcast from the live Voices of Montana radio show. Be sure to check out the full podcast page at voicesofmontana.com for a full listing of all our programs. We've been covering Montana issues for more than 20 years. Thanks for listening today.
You know, I got to remember to give that phone number out. Rob will take some questions. So we are at 866-627-5483 or a text message here for Constitutional Scholar Rob Nadelson at 781-627-5483. And welcome back to Voices of Montana. I'm Tom Schultz. We're on the road tomorrow. We're doing our show in Shelby. It's our tow rope tour. I'll get more on that here in just a little bit. But we're Shelby, Havre, and Malta Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Looking forward to that. Love getting out in the state of Montana. I know the same thing for our guest, Rob Nadelson, recently came back not that long ago, Rob, and got back and toured the state you love so much.
Oh, yeah. We spent a lot of time there this past summer. And as you know, Tom, I've got family in Montana. I've got two of my three daughters live in Montana in Columbia Falls. I've got two grandchildren in Montana. And we try to make it back as much as we can. I will say that I'm a little bit jealous of your ability, of your option of going to places like Shelby and Malta and Havre. I mean, that's one of the more neglected parts of the state, and I really love being in that area. We were just finishing up the question. You asked me the question of whether we ought to enshrine the number 9 in the Constitution as the number of Supreme Court justices and deny Congress the power to ever change that. And I said I didn't think so, that in the future it's possible we could contract the jurisdiction of the federal government and therefore want to reduce the number of justices. And similarly, as the number of people in the country expanded and the amount of legal business expanded, we might want to increase the number of justices. But we should do that for nonpartisan administrative reasons, yeah. not to try to game the system like some Democrats are talking about doing in Congress now.
Let me ask this then. If politics is a problem at the Supreme Court, and I think we saw that, it was never more evident to me than in the Kavanaugh nomination. Are there other ways to remove politics, or is it just going to take a will of the people to do it?
Well, this is something that's it's difficult for people to understand. But the power of the court largely reflects the power of the federal government. The court has seized some issues for itself, like abortion and same-sex marriage. But mostly the power of the court flows from the fact that the court decides federal cases and that Congress has injected itself into every nook and cranny of our lives. Congress, under the Constitution, is supposed to be a limited body, a lot of things it can't do. But when Congress passes laws and the president issues edicts covering every aspect of American life, COVID is the latest example, then naturally cases involving congressional and presidential action wind up in the court. The bigger the federal government is, the more the court decides, that means the heavier the stakes, the higher the stakes in every judicial nomination. So, you know, 100 years ago, court cases might involve such questions as the status of the post office or legislation involving interstate commerce. Today, court cases involve everything. And when the stakes are that high, that's when the political knives become unsheathed. So you're not going to get politics out of these judicial nomination fights, probably ever, but you're not going to be able to reduce it until you reduce the size and scope of the federal government. That's simply a reality of life, and thinking that we're going to do it any other way is simply being Pollyannish.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. And this kind of relates to what's going on in Montana here, the legislative branch versus the judicial branch. I want to get to that in a bit, though. But we do have a phone call. It's 866-627-5483. You can text us at 781-627-5483. Pat's been hanging on, listening on KCAP 950 AM in Helena. Pat, thank you. You're on the air with Professor Rob Nadelson.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Pat.
Hope you're well today.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions for Rob, and he did a nice job of telling me about the Supreme Court having to settle the question of the First and Second Amendment, where that's being combined, you know, with these citizen militias. Anyway, my first question, did I hear you, Rob, say that Antifa and Black Lives Matter incited the January 6th riot at the Capitol?
And no, I didn't say that.
No.
Okay, at the beginning of the
what program, I said is that no. What I said is that although the media characterized the Black Lives Matter and Antifa demonstrations of last summer as mostly peaceful, there were a considerable number of people who were not peaceful and who did engage in riots.
Okay, that explains it. All right, now number two, if the First Amendment, in Montana is now going to be changed because a bill was signed to make it unlawful to participate in a peaceful assembly if you were engaged in rioting at that peaceful assembly and that was no longer peaceful. And you mentioned something about intimidation. If a citizen militia shows up at a peaceful assembly, let's say out on that XL pipeline problem, with armed militia shows up there, who is responsible for turning that into a riot? Does that mean that's a riot then if someone with a weapon shows up?
No, it's not a riot. But this gets into some of the weeds of First Amendment law. The question is, at what point does a citizen militia become threatening? For example, does a citizen militia appearing to diminish other people's First Amendment rights or other people's expression? Or is a citizen militia acting in a way that's trying to clog government operations? Then you get into an area where it becomes appropriate for law enforcement to disperse the group. But the First Amendment law here is very complicated. It's not always terribly consistent. So I would have to answer a specific question. I would have to, you know the exact fact pattern, and then I would have to look at the cases and make a guess as to what the balance of First Amendment rights is. I realize that's kind of a squishy answer, but the reason it's a squishy answer is because the law in this area is really squishy.
Pat, thank you for that. I appreciate that. 866-627-5483 for another question here. I think she's referring to a recently passed piece of legislation in Montana. Well, actually, I think it was vetoed. We talked about it. The Institute for Free Speech had issues with it in relation to prohibiting the citizens' right to challenge the federal government. We looked at that. Well, I'll get into it more later on, Pat.
Yeah, I've not seen the text of the bill, or if there was a veto, the governor's veto message. So obviously, I can't comment on that.
Yeah, let's move to this one. The issue in Montana: the administrator of the Montana Supreme Court sends out a survey asking judges to weigh in on a measure that's moving forward in the legislature. It happens to be Senate Bill 140 to eliminate the Judicial Nomination Commission. That bill, that would give the governor of Montana, whoever it is, more authority to nominate the temporary replacement of a district judge who, for whatever reason, couldn't fulfill their full term. So that bill itself has become secondary to the issue of whether or not judges have prejudiced themselves in this matter by filling out this survey. And also, the legislature has other issues with it in terms of the deletion of some public records, the improper use of state resources. It seems to be a tug of war between the two branches here. Does the legislature have precedence, have authority to subpoena all the records from the Supreme Court and all the district judges, period?
Okay. I've not been involved in this controversy, and so to repeat a metaphor I just used, I'm not going to get too deeply in the weeds, but maybe it would help to lay out some of the structure, okay?
Yeah.
First, the legislature obviously has broad power to legislate. Similarly, legislatures have power to investigate as part of their power to legislate, and generally the power to investigate is as broad as the power to legislate. Thirdly, the power to issue subpoenas is part of their authority to investigate, right?
Yeah.
Fourthly, generally speaking, a legislature has authority to make laws pertaining not just to private citizens, but to other branches of government, including the executive and the judicial branch. That's why, for example, at the federal level, we see Congress investigating the executive all the time. I mean, it's part of Congress's job, because Congress wants to unearth any problems there might be and pass corrective legislation. Mm-hmm. So back to the state level, clearly the state legislature has the power to investigate the executive and the judicial branch and to issue appropriate subpoenas. However, and here's the big however, the power to issue subpoenas, like the power to legislate, is limited by constitutional protections. So, for example, if a legislature started issuing subpoenas against political opponents merely to suppress their free speech rights, that would be unconstitutional action. Now, where would a person receiving such a subpoena go for relief? Well, the person would go to the courts for relief and say, you know, declare this subpoena invalid. And the court would say the subpoena is invalid because the legislature's power to investigate is no broader than its power to legislate, and its power to legislate doesn't include the power to suppress free speech. Mm. But let's assume that the people being investigated are functionaries in the judicial branch. Where do they go for relief if they think a subpoena is invalid? Well, they go to the courts, right? But what's the problem? The problem is the courts now have a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue that the Montana Supreme Court had to deal with in the most recent case, in which they said, we're not going to recuse ourselves. We're not going to disqualify ourselves for having a conflict of interest, because these subpoenas are addressed at every single judge in the state, and we can't replace ourselves with any other judges in the state. Now, I'm going to express that those are all the facts. Now I'm going to express an opinion. And the opinion is that the Supreme Court should not have ruled quite that broadly. First off, I think the legislature's subpoena should not have been so broad. I think probably a bad decision. It was also bad politics. They should have focused their subpoena on the Supreme Court justices and their employees and the clerk specifically, not every judge in the state. Mm-hmm. But the Supreme Court of Montana acted too broadly, too, by simply saying, we're going to take this case. What the Supreme Court of Montana should have done is to say, we will exercise our inherent power to appoint what's known as a special master. That is to say, a trained lawyer or lawyers, it could be several special masters, to decide the subpoena issue. And we will commit ourselves to implementing, to enforcing, to turning into a judgment, anything that the special master decides that is, you know, not patently illegal. So in that way, even though Joe Judge could decide the case, a special master could decide the case, rather than saying, you know, we justices who are clearly in a conflict are going to decide the case anyway.
I only have 30 seconds left. Is that still possible for them to do that?
Yeah, it would be possible for them to do that. I wish they would do it. I also wish the legislature would narrow its subpoena to focusing on the Montana Supreme Court, because, as I've said many times before, the Montana Supreme Court has significant problems, has had for many years, and should be as transparent as other parts of government. And by the way, I don't think judges should be lobbying, period.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, it's good to catch up with you. Thank you so much. What are you doing for fun this summer?
Oh, well, I do a lot of day hiking.
Oh, nice.
Both in Colorado and in Montana. That's a primary way we have fun. We also play games and read and so forth. But in the in the winter, it's mostly skiing, and in the summer, it's mostly hiking, and of course, visiting friends and family in the great state of Montana.
Well, we hope to see you, and we'll catch up with you again, okay?
Thank you.
Professor Rob Nadelson, Senior Fellow, Constitutional Jurisprudence, the Independence Institute, and look them up, Denver, Colorado. Hey, back in just a bit here, when visiting Montana State Parks, remember to recreate responsibly, know the park statutes before you go, practice physical distancing, plan for facilities to be closed, play it safe by limiting potential dangerous activities. For more information on recreating responsibly in Montana's 55 state parks, visit fwp.mt.gov/state park.